This is a recording of the open session of the Federal Election Commission held on April 29, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Next item on our agenda, draft advisory opinion 2010-03, the National Democratic Redistricting Trust. We have with us this morning Mr. Mark Golias, who will feel free to join us at the witness table, who he's asked to be represented in this matter. Vice Chair, I understand we have a late submitted document.
Mr. Chairman, I move we suspend the rules on the timely submission of documents so we may consider agenda document 10-24.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. We have a presentation from Mr. Buckley from the Office of General Counsel, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 10-24 contains two draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted on behalf of the National Democratic Redistricting Trust. The trust was formed by private citizens and is not established, financed, maintained, or controlled by any member of Congress, any authorized candidate committee, or any national, state, district, or local party committee. The trust intends to raise funds to pay for pre-litigation and litigation costs that will arise following the next legislative redistricting process. The trust wishes to engage members of Congress to solicit funds on its behalf and asks whether members of Congress may solicit funds that do not comply with the Act's amount limitations and source prohibitions. Both drafts recognize that the threshold question is whether a member of Congress would be soliciting funds in connection with a federal or non-federal election. Draft A concludes that soliciting funds to be used to finance litigation associated with the redistricting process would not be in connection with any election and that, therefore, there would be no restriction on the amount of or sources from which a member of Congress could solicit funds. Draft B concludes that soliciting funds to be used to finance litigation would be in connection with a federal or non-federal election and that, therefore, members of Congress could only solicit funds that comply with the amount limitations and source prohibitions of the Act. The Commission has received one comment on the drafts, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. Are there any questions for counsel or for Mr. Elias? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where to begin? I think it'd be better to kind of merge what I'm thinking, and then I'll work some questions in for Mr. Elias because I do have some questions that I think will help flesh out everyone's thinking on this. There's two drafts, draft A and draft B. I support draft A. I hope I have the letters correctly. But draft A essentially says yes. Politicians can raise money for this redistricting fund. Draft B says no. I do have to say before I get going, though, and the public record reflects this, I filed an ex parte. Mr. Elias had called us yesterday, filed some additional comments, and I think we've all filed ex partes. I want to make sure the public's aware of that. It's out there perfectly legal. It's just we filed notices, and he just called and said, I filed comments, and let me summarize them for you. That being said, I don't understand draft B because the more I think it through, the more I just can't see it. Because first, long before the Federal Election Campaign Act was passed, there was reapportionment and redistricting. Read Federal Election Campaign Act many times, 1971 version, the amendments in the mid-70s, the 79 amendments. I can't find redistricting or reapportionment in there anywhere. McCain-Feingold was passed. I've read that a few times, too. I don't see it in there either. What I do see is a new rule in there saying that, essentially, to paraphrase, federal members of Congress and members of the Senate, federal candidates, other federal officials can't raise soft money. But it would seem odd to me that given that those folks who wrote this law and passed this law are professional politicians, and I don't mean that with any sort of disrespect, it's essentially what the Supreme Court said in McConnell, you think we have to assume that they know what they're doing. And if they wanted to limit their ability to raise money for redistricting or reapportionment-related matters. You think they would have said so. So I don't see the statute as giving the commission any sort of ability to change course. The commission has dealt with this issue a number of times over the years, and best of my knowledge and belief, it's always come out the same way, which redistricting, reapportionment is not in connection with the federal election. Certainly, it has something to do with federal elections. It feels like it might be part of a federal election, but that's not what the law is. The law is in connection with the federal election. Now, one commenter raised the issue that, well, the FEC has already taken the position in litigation briefs, and some have advised that we shouldn't talk about that here today, but well, we have to because it's raised in comments, and I don't think the tail wags the dog. What is filed in a brief does not somehow dictate what the commission says. But I've read the brief, and I think the comment overstates what the brief actually says. The brief's a public document; it speaks for itself. But if you want to actually read the brief, it's a section of the brief that responds to the unambiguously campaign-related argument made by the plaintiff in the RNC litigation. It's not really announcing a new rule. And in the context of the argument that it's being made, it does not, I think, affect what we do here today. Which brings me to the logic of B. And I use the word logic, but I'm not sure that's really the word to use. B, to me, causes all sorts of problems for everything. Because the commission, I think, has historically conflated reapportionment and redistricting. In this case, you're asking about raising money for litigation, right? You're not talking about actually drawing the map.
That's correct.
Okay. But under the logic of B, raising money to draw maps would probably also be a problem.
I think...
Is that how you would read it?
I read B as, and I say this realizing that someone or group of you among you were responsible for B, so I've thought about how to say this tactfully, but B neither makes any sense nor would have a limited impact, even forget about redistricting. I mean, B, let's start with the fact that B overrules Majette, and that's going to come as real news to people on Capitol Hill. I mean, if the fact is that members are no longer allowed to raise for legal expenses if those legal expenses relate to elections, then this commission has done something dramatic, And I think you need to look carefully at the language of the Majette.
Well, I hear you. But let me, my line of questioning actually even goes a completely different direction than that, right? Because at the end of the day, reapportionment is not drawing maps, it's who gets how many seats, right? Mm-hmm. So if raising money for litigation to maybe challenge that, there was a lawsuit last time, Utah thought they should get an extra seat and all that kind of thing. If that's in connection with a federal election, then is the federal government then spending money in connection with a federal election when they run those census ads?
And are states, which, I mean, the federal government, presumably the commission would say, yeah, but the federal government, for example, under the travel rules, the federal government's exempt, but as this commission knows, you have not exempted state governments.
Which,
and the question
last
is,
time
would
I
a
checked,
state government make an illegal campaign contribution?
Well, they would, right? Because isn't that soft money under the precedence of the commission?
It would
right?
Be,
state and local government taxpayer money is soft money. There's
certainly
on
in, the
point.
In the travel regulation context.
Right. So how would folks even draw maps? If the map is in connection with a federal election, you couldn't use soft money for it, right? So under B, how do governments even draw maps? Because ultimately the government draws the map, right?
Look, I think that the as I said, there is nothing about B. I think B doesn't answer the questions we've asked in their entirety. It doesn't, I think, square with the statute. It conflates at points the statutory provisions that deal with party committees with the provisions that deal with candidates. So it's hard for me to answer to you what B would do, because I think B would also undermine activity that this commission post McCain-Feingold has held is not subject to the prohibition. So, Commissioner, I don't mean to be difficult about this. It's hard for me to say what B would do because it's.
But it can go all kinds of directions.
It could be sweeping in a lot of different directions.
When all of a sudden, for the first time, the commission would say that redistricting is in connection with the federal election for purposes of federal campaign finance law, because that affects
again
so much of the funding.
Again, I think the reasoning of B goes beyond redistricting. I mean, I come back to something that we put in our comments, which I think is this commission needs to be mindful of, which is, you know, Congressman Shays established standing in the Shays litigation, the very litigation you all were just talking about. He established standing by swearing under oath that the reason why he had standing was because those rules you just were talking about affected his election. That's how he had standing. He had standing because he said the rules you passed were going to affect his ability to get elected. Well, I mean, geez, that's pretty direct. That's a candidate saying this campaign finance litigation is in connection with my election. It affects my election. If we go down the rule B, I assume that means that Congressman Shays couldn't have solicited money or volunteer support or other things unless it was conformity with the act. I think that's going to come as a surprise to Congressman Shays, and, you know, who knows, maybe.
And probably the groups that provided the legal support.
And perhaps the groups that provided the legal support. I mean,
actually brings me to my next question on B. What about other groups, nonprofits that are incorporated entities that participate in redistricting? I think about actually the commenter. For example, the commenter issued a press release after Lujack, which of course, right, and the person who works for the commenter represented Democratic members in the suit as a private lawyer, but yet the nonprofit sent out a press release talking about Lujack. Now, and he's at the NCSL conference a few weeks ago doing a presentation on redistricting. If redistricting is really in connection with a federal election, how can a nonprofit be doing all that kind of thing?
Again, I leave it to
the head scratcher.
I leave it to the commenter, and I leave it to you.
Okay.
I look at the commission's plain words in 2003-15, Majette, in which this commission said, quote, the commission has concluded that the limits and prohibitions of the act do not apply to monies given to a candidate's legal defense fund. The commission went on to further say, quote, commission concludes that 2 U.S.C. 441 IE1A does not change this result. So it said that McCain-Feingold didn't change that result. It then went on to say, and this is important, quote, there is no indication that the legislative history of BCRA, there's no indication in the legislative history of BCRA that Congress intended section 441 IE1A to change an area that is both well familiar to members of Congress and subject to long-standing interpretation through the statements of congressional policy and commission advisory opinions. That is this case. Members of Congress have had an understanding about the funding of redistricting litigation for decades, and this commission has contributed to that understanding for decades. And there is nothing in McCain-Feingold that changed that.
And
in Majette, this commission said that there's nothing in McCain-Feingold that changed that.
And with respect to your client, the litigation, and you may not be able to answer this today, but it's not going to be brought on behalf of a member of Congress. It's probably going to be brought on behalf of an individual voter, vindicating the rights of that voter.
I don't want to say for sure because I don't know.
Generally,
but
that's how
oftentimes redistricting litigation is brought on behalf
of voters. I mean, I can't
think
of a redistricting case where a politician was actually the lead plaintiff. It's usually a voter.
Typically, it would be brought
challenging
on behalf of voters.
I mean, the voting rights litigation, it's a voter. And now maybe the member of Congress, I'm a voter, I'm being...
I can't say for sure it would never be a member of Congress or won't be a member of Congress. I don't think that's material, but typically it would be on behalf of voters.
And if a voter does have a Voting Rights Act action, typically voters can't fund that out of their own pocket because it's quite expensive.
That is typical.
To cut off the funding for that is essentially affecting the voting rights of voters.
I think if this commission adopts draft B, I think it will have negative consequences for ensuring the litigation of important Voting Rights Act litigation and other things in connection with redistricting. And I think that Congress had an expectation when they wrote McCain-Feingold that they didn't touch redistricting. I think this commission has had a longstanding policy and practice regarding redistricting fundraising and member involvement in it. I think in Majette, this commission spoke clearly to this question. And I have to say, members of Congress are interested in a lot of things that have effects on elections or surround elections or may position the political environment more or less favorably. But that's what Majette was about. I mean, honestly, the litigation in Majette was a lot more directly election-related. I mean, one of the questions that I realize is not my place to pose questions to you is exactly what election is this in connection with? If a member raises money for the Redistricting Trust, what election is it in connection with?
I don't know, because if it's litigation about a map that's already been drawn, that's after the map's been drawn.
Correct.
And redistricting is a state-by-state process, generally in a state legislature. So it's a legislative vote. I don't know the answer to that. That was one of the questions I was going to ask you to sort of debunk that this is in connection with an election, because I can't put my finger on what election, other than some generalized notion that, well, obviously how you draw the map could have an effect on the outcome
right.
of an election. We've known that for years and years and years. Supreme Court said that years ago. Everyone said that. Congress knows that.
And why
is it not in the statute?
And as Congressman Shays pointed out, the rules of campaign finances affect elections. There's a reason why sitting behind me are a lot of lawyers who work for campaigns and parties, because what you do about solicitation rules affects elections. Does that now mean that all litigation involving campaign finance now becomes a question of in connection with an election, because it in broad sense affects elections? Majette was the place where you confronted this and you decided it. This matter was decided by Majette.
And
there's
a whole bunch of cases before.
Oh, sure, right. I'm sorry. In the post McCain-Feingold. Okay. Yes, you're correct. The reason of Majette is that, in fact, this has been the longstanding, repeated policy of the Federal Election Commission. I apologize, you're correct, Commissioner. I'm anticipating the question of, but didn't McCain-Feingold change it? And I actually think Draft A does a nice job. And again, I don't know who drafted which I think Draft A does a nice job of actually teasing out, you know, and frankly harmonizing a series of advisory opinions ranging from Majette and Berman Doolittle, where this commission did allow members to raise funds for redistricting not subject to the limits of the Act. And it brings those post-McCain-Feingold precedent into clarity and into order. And, you know, that is something, having just listened to you all, and I will join the chorus of probably maybe the first to say, to congratulate you for bringing some harmony to an area that has not always been easy to navigate in the case of non-federal fundraising. This is an opportunity, I think, to do that same thing in the post-McCain-Feingold era involving member solicitation.
Thanks for answering my questions.
I'm happy to.
Any further questions or comments? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you. Hi, Mark.
How are you, Commissioner?
I'm just fine. How are you? Other than enthusiastic.
I'm enthusiastic, and Commissioner, let me congratulate you. I noted that the Majette advisory opinion went out under your signature.
It did.
And with your vote.
It did. And we'll get to that in a second. I do want to first welcome back to the House our former chairman, Michael Toner, who I see sitting in the audience. Haven't seen you in a while, Michael, but it's always nice to have you.
I'm comfortable out here right now.
Okay, you stay out there.
He will always be Mr. Chairman to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Former chairman for life, right?
Right.
Yes, and as you know, I was very much involved in the Majette. I didn't just sign it. I was involved in crafting it, and I think it's you raised some interesting points about it. And I'd like to think that I didn't just craft that because I have a particular partiality for the House Ethics Rules on Legal Expense Funds, having drafted them. I mean, does it? One thing about Majette, though, is that it was linked to the fact that she was going to be doing this through a legal expense fund, and that would have inherent limits. And what you're asking today would allow members and, well, members are really the ones we're worried about, candidates, I suppose, but for the most part, it's members, to solicit unlimited soft money donations for this redistricting trust. And as you know, when, in various opinions that we have grappled with over the years, you know, we've tried to find ways to, you know, if to accommodate the political realities that are out there, you know, in recounts and host committees. I mean, there's a lot of questions that have come up over the years about things that McCain-Feingold arguably applies to, could be read to apply to, but aren't specifically mentioned in there. And, you know, this comes up on a regular basis, and we have to figure it out. For me, it was actually influential that in Majet, we weren't sort of opening the doors to unlimited soft money fundraising. We were saying, well, you can raise funds and consistent with the House rules, which set limits, which, while not exactly the same as the rules under the campaign finance laws, are similar. They're not way out of whack with it.
If I can react to that, I guess I react two ways. First of all, the House rules, and I realize I'm talking to a former counsel to the House Ethics Committee, so you will correct me if I misstate this, permit corporate funds. So to say that they are similar is actually not true. I mean, they actually permit impermissible sources of funds, and that is a significant, you know, that you say that we seek to raise unlimited amounts, and that's different than Majet. You're, I think, talking about limits rather than sources, and in some respects, McCain-Feingold is as much about sources as it is about limits, and indeed, there are places where Congress has restricted sources with being more permissive on limits. So I'm not sure that I agree with that premise, but I go to the central point that you make, though, and I reread Majet over and over and over again, and I want to go back to my first quote, and this is, Commissioner, over your signature. The commission has concluded that the limits, and prohibitions of the act do not apply to monies given to a candidate's legal defense fund. It doesn't say the prohibitions don't apply, but the limits do. In fact, it doesn't reference the House. I mean, it references the fact that it's a House legal expense trust, but it is not in any way the legal analysis contingent on the limits or the prohibitions. And indeed, the commission said quite clearly that neither the limits nor the prohibitions of the Federal Election Campaign Act applied under the circumstances. So I don't doubt what may have gone through your mind in Majet, but I don't find any textual support for that in the actual analysis of the opinion.
But should I be concerned about opening the door to unlimited soft money fundraising for, you know, people going out there and raising $1 million for a single
time? I don't think so. The fact is that this commission opened, first of all, let me back up. Congress did not intend to say members may only raise money under certain limits and certain prohibitions. They didn't say that. What they said is that in connection with elections, in connection with federal elections, there are these limits. So, indeed, members of Congress...
Or non-federal elections.
Right. My clients regularly raise unlimited funds for charitable organizations. They regularly raise unlimited funds for all kinds of organizations that are not acting in connection with elections. So,
But the charitable organizations are a little bit further away from their elections than this entity that's going to litigate the actual lines around the districts that
they're
going to run in.
Honestly, Commissioner, if you had dropped draft B, I'm not sure that's true anymore. I mean, what if a member of Congress raises money for a church or a synagogue or a mosque because they believe that their association with it will help their election? It's Chris Shates, except now it's raising money for charity. By supporting this church or raising money for this synagogue or mosque, it's going to aid my election. Or raising money for the United Way will make me look better in the community and aid my election. That's a kind of, this is a slippery slope. Draft B starts to bring this commission down a slippery slope. And that's not one that this commission has embraced. It didn't embrace it in Majet, where the issue was raising money for legal expense trust that actually dealt with the primary election structure. It actually dealt with elections. And most, perhaps even equally importantly, it didn't adopt that strategy. And Commissioner, correct me if I'm wrong, I know you're on the commission, I think you voted for the final rules involving the host committees where this commission held that members can solicit unlimited funds from unlimited sources for the host committees hosting conventions under the theory that the conventions don't act in connection with elections. They nominate candidates. But this commission took a practical, real-world view of how it is this country holds its conventions. And it looked back over the history and said, is this something Congress intended to change? And it didn't see any evidence of it. So it said, you know what? We're going to allow members to continue to raise money for nominating convention host committees. That's not in connection with elections. And again, go back to Majette, where this commission pointed to the fact that there was no evidence that Congress intended Section 441(i)(e)(1)(a) to change an area that is both well familiar to members of Congress and subject to longstanding interpretation. If that is the test of Majette for these gray area issues, two-part test, is it well familiar to members of Congress, and is it longstanding interpretation? Then I think this clearly fits the bill. The fact is, redistricting is very well familiar to members of Congress. I don't think there's a debate about that. And I don't think there's a debate that there's a longstanding interpretation the commission has taken in this area. So I don't frankly see how you square Majette. I don't think how you square the host committee decision and somehow pull out of that and say litigation to fund a challenge to the primary system is not in connection with election. And raising unlimited corporate money to put on a national convention where you nominate the presidential candidate is not in connection with election. But voting rights litigation, making sure that people's voting rights are protected, that's now all of a sudden the thing that tips us the other way, that's the thing we want to restrict and not allow members to raise money for. I don't see how that meets the test set out by this commission in Majette.
But it's not, I mean, it's nice to think of it in terms of voting rights, and maybe that's how the legal arguments are framed, but often the litigation also concerns making sure that the district lines are drawn in a way that is favorable to one party or another, sometimes even one particular candidate. You know, we know that district lines are sometimes drawn for particular candidates or parties. Now, I start from the proposition that, and you know, my colleague even acknowledged this, it sounds like it's in connection with an election when you're doing litigation around redistricting. I mean, it does affect the lines of the district and who's going to be in the electorate and perhaps who has a chance of winning in that particular district. But what I hear you saying is it is no more in connection with an election than other things that the commission has previously walled off.
Correct. And I think it's correctly walled those things off. And I think it's off because of the two-part test set out in Majette, which is it something that is where there are well-settled expectations among the regulated community? And here the answer to that is yes. And the second is it something where the commission has a long-standing settled interpretation? And there the answer is yes as well, both pre-McCain-Feingold and post-McCain-Feingold. And that's, Commissioner McGann, I was not trying to shortchange the plethora of opinions pre-McCain-Feingold. And you're right, it goes back. But it is also the post-McCain-Feingold precedent, whether you look at Berman Doolittle or you look at Majette, where the commission has said this same thing. And I think to change course while America is engaged in its census is kind of late in the game. Now, you could say, well, why didn't you bring your advisory opinion quicker? But honestly, if the commission was going to change this settled expectation, it seems to me this is a rather late time to do it and an improvident decision to make, because Commissioner, it is no more in connection, you are correct, it is no more in connection with an election than those other things. Indeed, I'd say it's perhaps less in connection with election than those other two things. And it's no more in connection with an election than campaign finance litigation. I mean, there's today, as we speak, there is you know, there's legislation being introduced involving Citizens United. The RNC has litigation right now involving the soft money ban. I mean, the fact is these pieces of litigation have consequences in elections. I'm the first one. I'll stand up and say it. Citizens United had consequences, will have consequences in the 2010 election. Okay? It did.
You're way out there on a limb.
Right. So, and I think most of the party lawyers sitting behind me are going to say the same thing. So does that mean now that all the litigation surrounding campaign finances become in connection with an election? for purposes of McCain-Feingold, there's simply no evidence that Congress intended to sweep into that phrase every piece of litigation that may touch on the electoral process.
I think that I think that I really do have to draw a line at McCain-Feingold, because I think McCain-Feingold changed a lot of things. Arguably this, arguably not, but arguably this. So I think that for me the more pertinent decisions are the ones that came post McCain-Feingold, and I think perhaps they're not as directly on point as you're suggesting. We have not actually. If we had had a decision that was directly on point on redistricting, I mean, Berman Doolittle concerned a ballot measure, and that adds another element to it. Majette concerned a legal expense fund, and that adds another element to it.
Berman Doolittle involved an actual election. I mean, it actually involved raising money for something that was on a ballot.
Right, but it was an odd situation where it was sort of on its own ballot.
We're on no ballot. It's hard for me to understand how we are asking something more aggressive than Berman Doolittle. Berman Doolittle involved an election, and the commission said, "Well, since it's not on a federal year ballot, it's okay." I'm not looking to raise money to affect any ballot. My client's not raising money to affect an on-year ballot, an off-year ballot, a special election ballot, a runoff ballot. It's just looking to fund redistricting litigation, which is, as the commissioner points out, frankly a catch-all for what is really voting rights litigation.
My point, though, is that if we had already decided this issue, if it were clear that we had already decided this issue, you wouldn't be here today. We haven't actually decided this issue. The closest that we came, actually, to this, and that was distinguishable, too, was the Engel request, which you're well familiar with, in which case we deadlocked. Now, Engel was different. Engel involved a unique redistricting fund that he wanted to set up. Mm-hmm. Establish, finance, maintain, and control. So that's, I acknowledge there's that difference. But it seems to me that that may well be the closest precedent on point, and we deadlocked on that one. I think it's a little bit less clear than what you're saying, which is why you're here and why we should provide clarity. I hear that. That's important. Is it your position that in order for something to be in connection with an election, it has to be in connection with a specific election? It's not enough that the redistricting will affect elections for a decade?
That is correct. It will affect election process. I'm the chair of the Committee to Modernize Voter Registration. We are looking on a national basis to ensure that all Americans have an opportunity to vote by being registered and not be trapped in a myriad of state and local laws and errors that are made at the local level that deprive them of right to vote. So we believe in modernizing our voter registration system. Undoubtedly, in a colloquial sense, it is related to elections. It has never struck me as plausible that is in connection with an election in the sense that the commission means it. Because if that's the case, then indeed I do sort of wonder where Commissioner McGahn's early hypotheticals lead us. Does this mean the National Association of Secretaries of State, if they decide to take up voter modernization, they are now somehow, do they become a PAC? If two of them, get money from two different places, then they,
I don't accept your slippery slope argument that, if you decide this, then there's this parade of horribles that's going to happen. I think we've got a particular question in front of us, and we're going to decide that particular question.
Particular questions, every time this commission rules, and certainly when it upends the existing precedent, there are consequences to that. I mean, I listened with interest. It reminded me a little bit of I think it was Justice, the Chief Justice, who said that you shouldn't need a campaign finance lawyer to engage in whatever it was that, I can't remember if it was Citizens United, but it was one of the cases that you, and now I have, Commissioner McGahn talking about you shouldn't need a campaign finance lawyer to throw a party event. So I'm feeling
trying
a little,
to put you out of business.
I'm feeling a little picked on here from a professional standpoint. But the point is that every time this commission throws doubt into the system, it only creates the problems that I just heard you all talk about trying to solve. I mean, if this, you can say that you're only deciding the case here, but if you adopt draft B, then I think you ought to just say, we are overturning all of it. It's a blank slate. You know what? Come one, come all, back to the FEC, because in fact, when we said that the limits and prohibitions of the Act do not apply to monies given to a candidate's legal defense fund, we didn't actually mean that.
Is this going to be a legal expense fund?
It is a legal expense trust, which, as you know from the House, is what it is not a. The fact that it is a legal expense trust is beyond question. That's what's been posited to the Commission. I didn't see anything in that what I just read that said it is a, you know, it is a House approved or a House. We use the House forms or whatever that process is.
Will House and Senate members who raise funds for this trust seek permission from their respective ethics committees?
I am here on behalf of the National Democratic Redistricting Trust. I always believe that members ought to comply with the ethical requirements of their chamber. And as you know, under certain circumstances, that requires pre-approval from the ethics committee. In other instances, it does not. And I would leave that. That's not something I can impose. That's not something the National Democratic Redistricting Trust can impose upon members. It would obviously make members aware of that they ought to abide by the ethical restrictions of their chambers, as just as for that matter, if they're not in Congress, you could have a governor or someone else who's not a federal elected official, they ought to abide by the ethics rules that govern them as well.
So if a member of the House or the Senate, well, I realize this is hypothetical, but if a member of the House or the Senate were to consult with their respective ethics committees and they were told that they can only raise funds subject to the House or Senate legal expense trust fund rules, they would be subject to those limits and what they could raise for your trust, presumably.
I mean, that's sort of tautological. I mean, yes, the members of the House are subject to the rules of the House as interpreted by, among others, the House Ethics Committee. So, and members of the Senate are subject to the rules of the Senate, including as interpreted by the Senate Ethics Committee and the Senate Rules Committee and the House Administration Committee and others. But yes, they will, I assume, follow the rules of their body. You know, I have no interest in leading members down a path of ethical violation. It's in my
particularly
day.
Particularly not since so many of them are clients.
I was going to say, in my day job, I actually try to prevent that. I don't want to mislead the Commission to the extent it's relevant to your consideration. That is not a burden of the National Democratic Redistricting Trust. That will be something that, any more than it's, you know, any other outside organization's burden. You obviously want the members. You have no interest in the members violating their ethical rules, so you try to ensure that they follow the rules they need to. But that would be their responsibility.
So suppose you've got a House member who is very motivated to raise funds for your trust because he or she feels very imperiled in the redistricting process, and goes out to friendly folk and says, you got to help me out here because, you know, this is going to be the premier organization doing redistricting litigation. I know I'm going to need help. I know there's going to be litigation around my district. And if I raise a lot of money, then I'm going to be able to go back to these guys and say, hey, you got to help me out. I raised a lot of money for you, right? And, you know, there would at least be some sense of moral obligation on their part to, you know, be nice to me after I raised a lot of money for them. Does that raise the same kind of corruption or appearance of corruption concerns as raising money for a principal campaign committee, you know, that justifies the limits on raising funds for principal campaign committees? And if not, why not?
I occasionally say this to the Commission, but it's usually to the folks sitting more over here than to over here. So I want you to all take this the right way. The job of the Federal Election Commission is not to write statutes. It is to interpret the statute that Congress has written. Okay, so whether there is an appearance of corruption or might be an appearance of corruption that is analogous to something else is a good thing for a legislator to determine in formulating statutes. You have the statutes that Congress gave you, and you have rules of construction of those statutes that this agency has relied upon in the past. My own personal opinion is no. to answer your question directly, I don't think it creates a risk of corruption. I don't believe it creates the appearance of a risk of corruption. I don't believe it creates constitutional harm. But I'm not here in a court arguing what the constitutional limitations of the act is, and I'm not here saying what Congress ought to pass by way of new laws. I'm here to say that under 441IE1A, under that statute which Congress did pass, this conduct is permitted, and indeed this commission has said on several occasions, Majet and Berman Doolittle being two of the more notable, that in fact that is the case, and that this commission ought not to depart from the well-settled path it's been on, you know, absent some extraordinary circumstance which simply isn't present here.
Very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions or comments? The Vice Chair.
Thank you. To follow up on the question that Commissioner Weintraub recently asked about members, which I appreciate that's not actually, there are no members as requesters, so
correct,
you're not in a position to answer them, but it strikes me that maybe that would actually be very helpful because they were be the ones raising the funds. So I'm just thinking through, we have an entity asking if other people can raise funds for it, and yet we don't really have the people it will be asked who will be raising the funds. And in some prior instances, you've raised a couple of AOs, the Berman Doolittle, and also an Engel. The persons who were interested in whether they could raise the funds actually asked those questions. Is there, you know, requesters are allowed to phrase their requests however they want, and whomever would like to make a request may. But is there any light you can shed on the particular approach taken here?
I mean, the approach taken was by the organization, and you know, there is a risk of chilling. And I know, having said this is not the forum to argue as if it's a court, but you know, there is a risk of chilling First Amendment speech if you make, you know, members have a lot of organizations they can solicit for, and if you're an organization like the National Democratic Redistricting Trust, one of the things you try to do, you know, apropos of Commissioner Weintraub saying, you know, would we advise them on the ethics rules? Well, you don't want to walk people off cliffs, right? You don't want to tell members, go raise money for us, go raise unlimited funds for us. Oh, geez, did we tell you that McCain-Feingold, meant to mention that to you. Okay, now, I know you have a complaint against you, but it'll all work out okay 3 years from now. Or 4 years from now, after you hire a lawyer and you go through this and your opponents hit you for raising self-money and all of that. So it's understandable that an organization would want to come forward to the FEC and say, look, this is what we do, and we would like to ask members to raise money for us, and we'd like an advisory opinion whether they may do so, and if so, under which set of rules. Because candidly, if you can't give that kind of if you can't do it as the organization, you face one of two possibilities. You've chilled the speech activity of the organization because you've put the burden now, the financial and other burden, on the member to do it. Or you potentially put the member at risk. And at that point, the members are going to say, why am I buying this risk? You know, you go to the FEC and figure out whether or not this is something we can do. So that's kind of a practical answer to your question.
I appreciate that. I think we should consider practical considerations are as legitimate as any other. I don't think I have any more questions, but from my perspective, I think that the discussion that we've had so far illuminates the real question is, what is in connection with mean? And I think that's different than what is a contribution, what is an expenditure, things are for the purpose of elections. It's slightly different that perhaps than affecting election. And, you know, and while I agree with you, Majet reached that conclusion, I think there was a very important factual difference that was available there that is not presented here. And, you know, while I'm not sure that not sure how I would have necessarily voted on that advisory opinion, but it certainly is precedent, and I appreciate that as a matter of a piece of our body of law that people have been able to rely on. So I appreciate that. But I'm still struggling with the question of, you know, frankly, in connection with is not the most illuminating set of words. Two prepositions, you know,
yeah, right.
Actually.
So I'd say two things to that. Oh, sorry.
I actually didn't have a question. I would just like to finish my my statement.
We had this last time also. I apologize.
It happened last time.
It did, but you reach a pause where it sounds like a question.
I'm a Minnesotan. I'm trying to be deliberative.
You'd think of all people I would know how to read Minnesotans.
They did allow you to stay in the state, which I was surprised at, given your maybe your behavior here today.
It worked out okay, though.
Yeah. I seem to like him there.
Now I've completely forgotten where I was going, which might have been your goal. So excellent on your part. I think, frankly, this phrasing is there probably are a number of logical ways to read it, and I think I'm still, frankly, struggling with what in this context is the most. Where does this fit on the scale? I mean, we have, you know, recounts, which are in connection with elections. We have Majette as, you know, standing out there, and we have host committees and charities and other things. And I think there's sort of this scale of things that are in some of which have been determined to be in connection with and some have not. And I think the question before us is, where does this one fall on that scale? And I understand some of my colleagues have, you know, have reached that conclusion. I have not quite yet reached that conclusion.
Okay.
So I don't actually have a question, but if you do, I'll turn it back to the chair.
For the Commissioner Walter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me announce that I did have a conversation with Mr. Elias yesterday. He sent an email and put in a call, and I was interested in communicating, and I participated in a conversation with him, and essentially it was most all of what you've heard today, a little more concise, but just as loud. And I did learn, you know, precisely with more precision exactly where the nuances are in your view, and I appreciate that. I asked yesterday the general counsel if she had a copy of the trust instrument, and I don't mean to be too invasive of what you're doing, but I think when we ask, when we say, can we support having a federal candidate raise unlimited amounts of money where everybody knows it can affect the outcome of the election? Let's get this behind us. It can affect the outcome of an election in which the candidate's involved. To have a little more of an understanding of the entity. And especially, I mean, I look at the statute that said what you can and can't do, and one of the, you know, general exceptions are is that you can't, they can raise unlimited money for a 501c3. Okay, that's understandable. And so it's a little off the table in terms of other candidates who can raise unlimited amounts of money. That's settled in that statute. This wasn't. Statute didn't say that about some other type of entity. And I was just curious to know if you could give me some information about the trust, really. And if there's a particular reason why it can't be made available to us, I guess that's up to you. But I was just curious, and I don't want to be too invasive, but I think it's something we could justify asking for, or at least some information about it.
Sure. And what I relay back to counsel is that if there are questions about the trust that you have that relate to the merits of the opinion, I'm here and happy to answer them. The trust is not a public entity. And it, if I give it to you, you have to put it on the public record. And I think that given the nature of what a trust is, that's not something that's reasonable. It may be reasonable to ask, but it's not reasonable to expect. It's not something that initially counsel, the general counsel's office requested at the point at which the request was made. We've made certain representations as to who the trustee, what the category of person is who is the trustee and controls the trust. And we've made certain representations as to what the trust's purpose is and what the funds will be spent for. And obviously, if those representations are not correct, we don't enjoy any benefit from any advisory opinion that we might receive. So we have a strong incentive to assure you that those are correct. If there are particular details about it that I can be helpful in supplying, I will do my best to do so, but that's the long answer to your question.
Okay. The Really, it was a no.
Correct.
But, in a lot of respects. So we say to Canada, hey, you can raise a limited amount of money here. And they go out and they get an Exxon equivalent, say, Corporation B. And they give $1 million. And we don't know exactly all of the purposes that are in that entity, what they all may do or may not do, or who's going to be spending the money, or what they're not going to do. And I think I'd want to ask you as we go along here, is it possible at some point that the candidate might end up a joint party with a trust in fighting a certain kind of decision on districting, for example? Is it possible? Isn't it possible that the candidate might become a party in the redistricting litigation?
Sure, absolutely.
With the entity for which a lot of money was being made?
Absolutely. Okay. And Commissioner, and this is where I apologize for being repetitive, but I am just...
Obviously, it's necessary.
I am somewhat taken almost aback. I sat in this room while you all decided that my client, my other clients, members of Congress, could raise unlimited money from ExxonMobil, from any corporation in the world, unlimited, to throw a convention to nominate candidates for office. And that was not in connection with an election. That was not in connection with election. The actual nominating...
Is that a mistake?
No, I think it was the right decision, but that's not a nominating convention. I wasn't here the day that Majette was decided, but let's just strip the bark off this tree. Majette involved litigation over her primary ballot. Over her ballot, not someone else's ballot, not ballots for 10 years. Over her primary ballot. It was her election she wanted to raise corporate money from. Let's not dress this up as regulated somehow by the House. This is corporate money she wanted to be able to raise. And this commission said yes. And it said yes in both of those circumstances because the two-part test that you laid out in Majette was met, which is what are the settled expectations of the regulated community over a long period of time, and what are the commission precedents. And I don't understand how it can be that voting rights litigation, assuring the rights of people to have their votes counted in a redistricting and reapportionment process, is more in connection with an election and subject to more regulation by the FEC than throw in a convention where you nominate a president and litigating, raising corporate money to change the system of getting yourself through a primary. So that's the place where I'm struggling, though I'm not in a position to struggle. You all do the struggling.
But if you knew it was black and white, we wouldn't be here. When we're trying to figuring out how to kind of noodle our way through the various issues that, you know, some of our history and some of the new law and the considerations involved, and when we interpret something, whether it's in connection with or not, it has long-term implications in other areas, as you well know. And so in this particular case, if the entity... It could be a co-party in the redistricting litigation. I mean, I think I'm not saying it's naive. That's the last thing you are. But on the other hand, let's face it. Most of the people that are going to be raising money in the federal ones are House candidates. It doesn't relate so much to the Senate. Doesn't relate so much to the presidential election. It's the House candidates. And the most thing they're concerned about is the next election within 24 months or less. Hmm. And they're the ones that are doing it, and they know that how that gets done affects their election. And it doesn't affect whether people have the right to vote. It really affects who they have the right to vote with.
And Congresswoman Majette, when she was soliciting corporate money to change the primary system in Georgia, to challenge Georgia's primary system, was doing it for her election.
Exactly.
When the presidential campaigns raise money for the conventions, they're raising it for a convention coming up in a few months, and they're raising corporate money, they're raising labor money, they're raising unrestricted, unlimited funds. So that has never been the test. That was never the test before McCain-Feingold. It was never the test after McCain-Feingold. I was very clear with the counsel's office. I never said we were acting, that there was a wall or some kind of non-coordination, which is why I freely acknowledge members of Congress could be, it's not often that they're co-plaintiffs, but they could be, and I'm not here to say that somehow we won't coordinate or that members won't otherwise have any involvement in the litigation decisions. I don't want to mislead the commission. It's the last thing I want to do. But how is that any different than the line that of the Berman Doolittle? The Berman Doolittle AO involved redistricting. The only thing that I keep hearing about Berman Doolittle that's different is that it was that the ballot, the redistricting question, was on the ballot in an off year. It involved redistricting. Would I be better off if I tell you we're going to raise money for redistricting litigation, and by the way, we're also going to put it on a ballot? I mean, I feel like then I get more protection than if I tell you we're not trying to influence the ballot at all. We're actually trying to take a step back further from the process than what was permitted in Berman Doolittle. Now, let me finally just say, I've now been asked, or it's been commented three times, well, if this was clear, why are you here? And the answer is, there are times you seek an advisory opinion for the reasons that I said to Commissioner Bowerly, which is you're asking members to do something. And undoubtedly, you can read the newspapers. As we sit here today, there are members already raising money for redistricting. Okay, not for the Democratic tradition, not for my client, but for other organizations, because a lot of the regulated community believes this actually is a settled question. And if you wind up in a deadlock, you're back in the some do it, some don't do it. Complaints get filed, the complaints will get dismissed, you'll either heckler v. Cheney them, which I love when you do that, the commission ought to be able to speak clearly and harmonize, which is why I complimented the draft B. It takes Berman Doolittle, it takes Majette, it tries to draw a line. Draft A tries to harmonize that and say, okay, regulated, just like we did two things today at the FEC, which were good. Number one, we streamlined your state and local party events with your state candidates. So you got one set of rules. You don't need a lawyer to worry about that. Thank you, Commissioner McGann. Number two, we have streamlined the redistricting world. You can stop sending in various AOs with 1,000 different iterations because we've kind of come to a place where we can draw some reasonable lines. And by the way, we may have even done that with restricted class, or at least we've taken a step down the road of doing that with restricted class. Be a threefer here at the FEC.
In all those that you mentioned before, they have involved money going exactly where we know it's going to go. In this particular case, I'm not trying to say it isn't so, but I think that we're somewhat in the dark. I am. Of what the powers and goals are in any particular trust. And I say that not because of, because I know you, I know some of the people that are involved, I trust you all, but along comes the next trust.
Uh-huh. But
and we don't know who that trust is, and they want to raise money for a certain thing, and we have no idea really what it's all about, and they won't show us the trust instrument.
But Commissioner, I don't want to perhaps indict myself and my legal advice. I got clients who raise money for trusts all the time where I don't come to the FEC because honestly, it doesn't involve you. The fact that
That's
members
great.
Raise for trusts, there could be an environmental trust. There are environmental trusts. Members raise for, I may go to the House Ethics Committee, I may go to the Senate Ethics Committee because there are some ethics rules. I don't go to the FEC. It's not in connection with election. It's not your jurisdiction. The fact that there is a trust that may do, quote, other things, maybe the National Democratic Redistricting Trust on the side will decide to support a church, a mosque, or a synagogue, okay? Maybe we'll decide to save an endangered species, okay? There are all kinds of trusts. Maybe we'll start a land trust to put in land as offsets for cap and trade, okay? Under those circumstances, I wouldn't come to the FEC and ask this question. So I've come to the FEC with respect to this trust to ask because, honestly, what the trust is going to do is not do land purchases for cap and trade. It's not going to support religion, and it's not going to do those other things that I wouldn't come here for. I'm coming here because I'm acknowledging up front that the trust is going to do something that the commission might have an interest in blessing, or if not blessing, or at least approving the that it does not violate the campaign finance laws. But I don't think there is a general requirement that members raising for trusts are within the jurisdiction of the FEC, and I wouldn't typically bring those matters to the FEC.
That's all I have at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'll just add just a couple of comments myself. Okay. Well, if you want to ask the questions, why don't you go ahead?
I think a couple of us were playing around with. I know you say we shouldn't be concerned about the potential for corruption here, but that's more of a legislative concern. But I think some of us actually are a little concerned about that. And one way of addressing that I think has popped into some of our heads is there some way we could cabin this off and say, yes to senators and no to House members, because we know that senators aren't going to be affected, their races aren't going to be affected by the redistricting process. I couldn't come up with a legal theory that would support that. I was wondering if maybe you had any insights on that thought.
I'm glad you added that last piece, because I had a momentary panic as I thought, okay, how am I going to explain the legal theory behind that? Unless you somehow say it falls under, what is it, 441AH allows the senatorial committees to make contributions to Senate candidates. I think that's the only provision I can think of that applies to senators. I guess the AD limits would apply to senators and not, would be different for members of Congress than senators. But I don't think in this arena there's any
I just want to make sure I'm not missing something.
I wish I could grasp onto something for you, but I got nothing.
Similarly, I couldn't come up with any way that popped into my head how we could structure some kind of compromise where we said, yes, but subject to some limits. This is really kind of an on-off switch, right? You know, either we say yes or we say no.
Correct.
All right. like to look for compromises.
I hear you.
I guess the only other question is sort of a small point. You had said at one point that you thought the draft B confused the laws that apply to candidates with those that apply to party committees,
yes.
And I wanted to give you an opportunity to elaborate on that point.
Well, draft B jumps sort of with both feet at one point into the current RNC litigation. And cites some comments. My recollection is from that opinion. I'm trying to find the. It's the three judge. It is a cite to the RNC v. FEC case, which is kind of, honestly, it has the feel. And as a partner in a law firm, and I know some of you have been at law firms, it has that feel that like someone just said, ooh. There's a case. It involves campaign finance. I think they said something about redistricting. Let's just sort of plug it in. And maybe no one will, it's kind of like, ooh, maybe that'll be interesting. The RNC litigation has nothing to do with this case. It has nothing to do with this case for the good, for the bad, for people on one side, for people on the other side. The RNC litigation involves a national party committee, which is, as you know, subject actually to a different statutory provision than the one we're talking about. It involves a constitutional challenge by the RNC to the statute. I'm not here challenging the constitutionality of the statute. So this, to the extent that this paragraph is there to lend some support to the position that is being asserted, it like I said, it just has the feel like you were running or someone was running short on legal analysis, because if you take that paragraph out, there's really only, a page. So it felt like if we just put a paragraph in where we sort of quote from the RNC decision, it'll feel more substantial. But it is. I think it actually confuses, and it probably goes to some of the things that I got the impression you all don't want to talk about or can't talk about or whatever involving litigation. Putting this in raises a whole bunch of questions of are you somehow assuming that the RNC litigation turns on whether or not members can raise for an organization they don't control? I mean, it seems to me it confuses two very, very different provisions and is not helpful, frankly, to the FEC's position in that case. So I wouldn't support, as someone who supports the FEC's position in that case, I wouldn't put that in there.
I just want to make sure I understood your point on that. I take it you wouldn't have any objection to a short opinion that said yes.
I think twice that I'm aware of, once involving Third Millennium. I can never remember if it was Third Millennium or Second Millennium or
some millennium.
It was a millennium. And then a second time, I think actually in
Berman Doolittle.
The commission simply answered the question yes, and then each of the commissioners then were able to explain what they meant by yes. And for our purposes, a yes will be just fine.
You don't care what comes after the yes.
So you know, a yes with opinion to follow, or a yes, you know,
with no opinion to follow.
I'll take a yes and escort myself out and drop the little badge in the thing at the desk.
Vice Chair.
Thank you. I would like to note for the record your generosity in taking a yes in whatever form you can get it. I'd like to go back to the host committee issue for just one moment. I wasn't at the commission when this rule was put in place, but when I go back and read that E&J, I think it's, while I appreciate the argument and I and its logic that host committees are about conventions which are about nominating a candidate, the commission said that the principal purpose of a host committee or municipal funds was to promote and generate commerce in the host city.
Absolutely.
And that was important.
Absolutely. That's why we have conventions.
That's right.
Because we want to make sure that the cities are adequately stimulated in the economy. That's right. And
I'm
you can give me the AO and say the answer is yes, because the purpose of redistricting litigation is to promote voting rights.
May I ask my question now? Okay. That was important to this analysis because there's a provision dealing with 501c organizations, and my question is that's not our context, right? This is not a 501c organization.
It is not.
Okay, just trying to understand where things fit.
Yes,
Thank you.
It is not a five. Is that a question I get to answer or no? If it is not a question, I won't answer.
It was a question. I believe you answered it no. is that correct?
That is correct.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I have any questions.
Then I'll be quiet.
Yes, that's what that
but
means.
You
thank
might.
You.
Right. He'll tell you.
I'm usually pretty good at containing when I'm asking questions, but today you just all over. A couple thoughts. First, going kind of turn back the clock to something that the Vice Chair was talking about is why you don't have a member of Congress perhaps asking for this AO as opposed to the group. If there's a complaint filed because a member of Congress raises this money, it'll probably be a MER, and of course not prejudging. There'll probably be discovery. Your client would be subject to discovery. So it seems to me you do have standing to ask this request because you do have potential exposure, at least in the sort of process of the enforcement process here, even if you are not necessarily on the hook ultimately for some sort of finding against your client. Two, just because someone asked for an AO, I don't think we can have a presumption that they know that somehow the answer isn't the answer that they want or that it's an open question. People ask for AOs all the time that are rather routine, mundane. They simply want the protection. In fact, many times things are crystal clear, but House or Senate Ethics would like to see an FEC advisory opinion before green-lighting something that they've green-lighted for member after member after member after member. So I don't think, and I think it's not healthy to suggest that because you asked, therefore there's some significance to be taken from that, particularly after Citizens United. A lot of ink spilled about the AO process, prior restraint of speech and all that kind of thing. You know, and AOs here take a little while. You filed this way. Your letter's dated in February. It's now basically May. You know, it takes a while for these. That's something that I think discourages people from filing AOs. The fact you asked for it, I think, is not something we can hold against you. My second point is really the whole shooting match is whether redistricting, reapportionment, related issues in connection with the federal election. It wasn't in connection with the federal election before McCain-Feingold. I can't find anything in McCain-Feingold that says it is. Commission doesn't seem to have a statutory basis to say it is. Maybe there's something in the legislative history. Maybe there's anecdotal evidence. Not to introduce that anecdotal evidence, but my recollection is it wasn't covered for a reason. And given that they were very detailed, they being Congress in so many other ways when it came to raising money. And I'm not even going to call this soft money because soft money denotes sort of non-federal election.
That's right.
And that kind of thing. And it's not even really hard or soft. This is a different kind of money. But I can't find it in McCain-Feingold, and I haven't heard any arguments today that address that issue and actually put a fine point on why McCain-Feingold changed the world, other than they wanted to break the link between politicians and soft money. We all know that, but they didn't do that in all instances. They picked and choose when they wanted to do that. So I haven't heard any argument in favor of saying McCain-Feingold statutorily changed things. Third, this has been a hard discussion to listen to because of cynicism is the only word that comes to mind. It seems that people assume that members of Congress can raise money for redistricting litigation, which somehow rigs their election. Don't the voters matter? I would think they do. Even if you do a gerrymander, voters still can vote. If you look back in the history of elections and redistricting, numerous examples of people trying to rig the election through the redistricting process, and it backfires on them. Remember in Georgia, for example, after the 90 census, they drew the map. The Democrats drew a map really designed to take out one member of Congress. Not only did they lose most of their members in the process, that member of Congress not only got reelected, he became Speaker of the House after the 1994 election. Staking in Georgia, since that seems to be the favorite state, the Majette matter, the Gingrich matter. Last go around, the state legislature decided to try to draw a seat. Champ Walker was the leader, drew a seat, and he thought he lost his reelection. He drew the map. He drew the map for the congressional election, as I recall. Champ Walker Jr. ran in the seat that on the street was supposedly drawn for him, and he lost. So the idea that you can rig the election through redistricting is a dubious proposition to begin with. But now we're going to say that, well, clearly raising money for litigation is in connection with an election, because when members raise money, it's going to help their election. You know, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but that's not the statutory language. Moreover, looking at history, think about Shaw v. Reno. Did Mel Watt care about the result of Shaw v. Reno? Absolutely he did. Maybe he raised money for Shaw v. Reno, but what about the next Mel Watt? Maybe members of Congress want to raise money for redistricting because they actually do believe in voting rights. And maybe it's for selfish reasons today, but there's probably a lot of other people who raise it not for selfish reasons. I would suggest that really the folks who are affected the most by the redistricting are not necessarily the folks raising the money. It tends to be the leadership and the heavy hitters who tend to come from safer seats. Now, occasionally you have someone in leadership who is in a seat that where, you know, you not necessarily have an overwhelming party advantage. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of reasons why folks would want to raise money for redistricting. And to choke off the ability of these groups to fund litigation on behalf of individual donors in a way that Congress did not clearly state, particularly when it's the members of that Congress who are going to raise money, just doesn't make sense to me. Because I ask my colleagues to think about the bigger picture. What's at stake here? And certainly we can go narrow and think, well, is there corruption or appearance thereof? Maybe a member of Congress is going to ask someone for money, and that could cause a problem and all this kind of thing. But in practical matter, think about the next Mel Watt. I mean, this is litigation for redistricting takes years and years and years. It goes to the Supreme Court. It gets remanded. It goes back up to the Supreme Court. This is not unlike the campaign finance jurisdiction, three-judge panel, right to the Supreme Court jurisdiction. They have to take the case. And by the time these cases are decided, whoever raised the money for the litigation is probably long gone or retiring. And maybe the next person is going to run for the seat. So when we think about raising money to vindicate voting rights of voters, I would suggest we can't take a myopic view and just see it as one politician trying to feather their own nest. This is a much bigger picture, much more important for us to do. And I think as a federal agency, we really can't sit up here and really publicly say that politicians are rigging redistricting and therefore the voters don't matter. It's simply not that simple. There's much more to it than that. And I really hope we can adopt Draft A, because to me, that is, as a public policy matter, setting aside the law, as a public policy matter, is the much more long-term sound view. So that's my pitch, Mr. Chairman. And I don't have any questions for Mr. Elias on that, because it's almost lunchtime.
Let me also second that I also support draft A. I think that, you know, questions have been raised about, you know, the potential for quid pro quo corruption in terms of raising money for redistricting trusts. And, you know, I can see how hypothetically those may arise, but I can also think of a lot of activities that could give rise to quid pro quo corruption relating to federal candidates, and those fall well outside the jurisdiction of this agency. I think it's instructive to remember the statute and the name of the statute that we administer and enforce, which is the Federal Election Campaign Act. Our mandate is to enforce provisions that deal with quid pro quo corruption, or the potential of that, or the appearance of that, as it relates to campaigns, as it relates to how money is raised and spent with respect to candidate advocacy communications, to candidate advocacy events, to voter mobilization activities, how you pay for your staff and how do you pay for consultants, things that are intimately tied and directly related to how campaigns are conducted, and that relate to influencing voter behavior in specific elections. And in connection with the phrase, that bedeviling three-word phrase, when viewed in isolation, it can maybe be a little bit unclear about what is in connection with an election and what isn't. But we're not drawing on a blank slate here. We have a whole history of advisory opinions and both pre and post McCain-Feingold. And at this point, I think that the way in which this commission has gone in the past, I think in a very clear direction with regard to whether redistricting falls on which side of that line. I cannot say here that I can say with specificity what is in all cases, what falls on which side of the line of what's in connection with and what's not. But I feel very confident in saying that wherever that line is specifically, I can give you a general direction. I can't point specifically, but redistricting is well on the other side of that line. What 441 IE was concerned with was members raising soft money to organizations that could then funnel that money back, that would directly benefit their campaigns, that could directly go towards voter mobilization activities, communications that were going to influence voter behavior with respect to those particular elections. And I think that's what the provision was designed to get at. Again, We can't. Our mandate is not to root out all potential quid pro quo corruption. It is only as it relates to campaigns. And similarly, if our jurisdiction is now extends to not only those things that are intimately tied to campaigns, but also to activities that have a substantial impact on the electoral process, then we better double our budget requests, because we've got a lot more that we've got to be looking at. So for all of these reasons, I'm in support of draft A, and I don't know if we're ready to make motions, but if now's the appropriate time, I'm all for it. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that I've really focused here today on trying to get some helpful information from the requester, and I really appreciate the enthusiastic participation of the requester's counsel here, and it's been very helpful to me. You know, for some of us, this is a harder question than for others of us. So, you know, I respect that some people look at this and they say, I know the answer, and that's clear to me, and that's fine. I'm sure that my colleague did not mean to suggest that those of us for whom it is a more difficult question are accusing members of trying to rig elections. I mean, you know, people want to raise a lot of money, and everybody wants to have a lot of money in their campaign account, and they think that's going to be helpful to them. That doesn't mean you can buy an election. In fact, we all know of instances where people have had tons and tons of money and have still managed to lose elections. But, you know, there are certain considerations that underlie the law, and we're just grappling with how they apply in this situation, which I think is a little bit ambiguous. So I very much appreciate that the Requester's Counsel came in and has tried to be so helpful to us in that regard. And I guess I'm going to ask if he would like to be even more helpful to us, and perhaps to himself. For those of us who are struggling with this issue, and you know, are still grappling with it, and may not be ready today to vote for draft A, but you know, would still like to think about whether there is something, some version of that that maybe we could support. Maybe there's some different language that might be persuasive to us. And we just like a little bit more time to mull over all of the good information that we have received here today. I don't know where we are on the 60-day tomorrow. So in that case, we really would need some help from you if we were to I'm guessing I may not be alone in thinking that I'm not quite ready to pull the trigger on this one today. Do you think that you could give us a little bit more time to try and come up with an answer for you?
I guess let me answer it three ways. First is I have granted the commission extensions in past AOs and have, as often as I am before the commission asking for an extension in other contexts, I am loath to ever say to the commission, you can't have a reasonable extension when you
not
need
to mention
it.
All the AOs you ask for, Mark.
Well, yeah,
you do give us a lot of business.
The second thing is I am mindful of the fact, without asking the chair to reveal information he doesn't wish to, I am mindful from the announcements earlier that there may be a impending absence of a commissioner who has already expressed an interest in supporting my position. So I am loath to go from six commissioners to five commissioners. As I sit here,
I don't think he's going to be out of communication entirely. So I don't think you lose his vote by doing
which
this.
Which brings me to the third thing, which is, you know, if the question is, we are inclined towards yes, and we want to not take up the time now because we have a busy agenda to figure out the language and then come back to you know, then come back with, then I think that that's a perfectly reasonable thing. I guess I think at the end of 60 days, my client has some reasonable expectation and understandable to at least understand where the commission is. If the commission is going to deadlock or vote no, then I guess I'd just assume let's just have it. You know, just tell me that, you know, we're just that's just the way it is. If the answer is, you know, we may not be entire, as you say, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Okay, so If the answer is draft A isn't my perfect cup of tea, and there are things I'd like to work on with it to get to a place where I am yes, then I think that's a different. I think that's a different request than, you know, we just want more time to. Do you know? Do you understand?
The answer is somewhere in between. Speaking just for myself, I mean, if I knew today that no matter what I was going to say no to you, then I wouldn't make the request. I'm not making a commitment that I'm going to say yes to you either. I'm just saying that you certainly have a better prospect of getting yes if you give us a little bit more time than you would have sitting here right today if you force us to vote on it and give you an answer right now. I think that you've provided a lot of interesting and helpful information. I found it very informative, and despite the fact that it's been long, it's never been boring. And I just like to think about it all a little bit longer, and I think that I'm guessing that I may not be alone in that, and you won't do worse by you won't do worse by giving us a little more time.
Well, then that, you know, it's as they say, an offer you can't refuse. Mr. Chairman, I do raise the concern that I have, honestly, about losing what, and I don't mean to commit you to a vote, but I think you announced my little tally here that you were inclined towards a position that would be favorable, right. And I would not want to set this.
One thing that I think we should consider is that just because we have a vote on an AO, if we don't pass it right here and now, it doesn't mean that there isn't a possibility to consider future drafts. I'm wondering if one thing we may want to do is find out is to have a vote on draft A. And see where the votes line up and go from there, the Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Someone could, of course, make that motion. I would not be able to support Draft A at this point in time. As I think my discussions with Elias have elucidated, the reasoning in Draft A is not persuasive to me because I actually draw the line where Commissioner Weintraub does. I think it matters after BCRA, and I think that there are a couple of important goalposts, host committees and Majet being a couple of them, and I would like some more time to consider whether there is a yes that I could get to, but it's not draft A. So you could make that motion. I can't speak for my other colleague, but I suspect it may fail, and you know I don't know what that gets us if the requester is willing to give us a little more time.
I have another question.
Mr. Walter.
I have another question. If we're, are we going to be able to ask some more questions at this point? Let me ask a question while I can. As you know, I've asked you some questions about who you are. It's not so much that I distrust who you are, but we're going to get a question in the future or different experiences with what other people are who are doing this. So now we know that a corporation is a person and can raise unlimited amounts of money, you know, for independent expenditures, and I'm being a little bit, you know, I guess it's my reaction to the decision. But suppose somebody files a decides they're going to raise money for a friend, and that person simply wants to get involved in redistricting litigation. We have no idea what position that person's going to take, but the candidate can now raise unlimited amounts of money for his friend who wants to engage in redistricting litigation. Now, where does that leave us at this point?
I think it is a bridge you crossed in Berman Doolittle. The fact is,
Keep talking. The
commission said that members could raise unlimited funds for an organization that, as I recall, was opaque to the commission. I mean, completely opaque to the commission.
It doesn't mean we have to do that again.
Well, but that's true, Commissioner. That is absolutely, and that is a fair point. You don't have to do it again. But I think that this commission is, I do a lot of time defending this commission to people who say it's partisan or it deadlocks or it can't, you know, the law is too complicated. And honestly, Commissioner, you can reverse whatever precedent you previously have. I don't think it serves this commission well to take an advisory opinion that dealt with raising by members for redistricting. That is not that old. I don't know how many years old Berman Doolittle is, but it's recent. And say for a committee where you...
2005.
I mean, well after McCain-Feingold, and say we are now going to reverse our position, we are now going to reverse Berman Doolittle under circumstances where, you know, there isn't that much, candidly, that much factual difference, and we're also going to reverse Majet under circumstances which involve the trust. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, and I got questions about before, but Majet was raising for trust. And I don't, you know, you can check the record whether there was a request made at that point for a copy of the trust or whether they submitted it, and perhaps they did. If they did, it didn't seem to be a fact that was, you know, that drove the decision. It didn't seem to appear in the legal analysis, but again,
it would have been public record if it was a House legal expense trust. It would have to have been disclosed at some point.
Was it disclosed to the commission before it was set up? Was it disclosed to the commission before the advisory opinion? I don't know.
That enormous.
I don't know. But I know that most of the 501Cs that walk in here for the advisory opinions are completely opaque to the commission.
But there's a statutory exemption.
The question in Berman Doolittle was, could a member raise an unlimited amount of money for a 501c organization whose principal purpose is a ballot initiative for redistricting? Okay? It involved raising unlimited money for redistricting. The statutory exemption, Commissioner, only kicked in that case if it wasn't in connection with an election. And this commission said in Berman Doolittle that members could raise an unlimited amount of money for that ballot initiative because it wasn't in connection with an election. I have tried not to lean too heavily on Berman Doolittle because I have sensed that there is some apprehension among some commissioners around it, but maybe I should be more direct and full-throated about it. That is a precedent of this commission that sits here. It is here. It is.
You recognize that I'm the only one who has voted for your two major precedents. Everybody else has been here since.
I understand, Commissioner, and I pointed out you signed at least one of them. you didn't just vote for it. You signed it, and you also voted for the rulemaking on the National Party Committees doing civic development for cities. it's good. You know, the commission should get stimulus funding to help develop inner cities.
Are you saying that the witnesses who came in and gave us all that testimony about what those host committees were doing were lying to us,
Mr. Elias? No, I'm being quite serious. I think it's great that they developed the cities. I think that's right.
We had a lot of testimony.
I'm here agreeing. I think that's right. So,
but just to get a response back to my question. What I guess I hear you saying is that it doesn't make any difference who the recipient of the money is, as long as the candidate says that I am raising money for that recipient to use it for redistricting.
Correct. As long as, and it is being used for that purpose. I mean,
well, how do we know that?
Well, you don't. Well,
what are we going to do to prove it?
Honestly, you don't know that in any case.
Okay, but that's the point.
But Commissioner, you don't know when a candidate says I'm raising money for a state candidate uses for their election. When someone says I'm raising money for a state party, you don't know what the state party's using it for. When they say I'm raising it for a charity that does no elections, you don't know what the charity's doing. This commission never audits through.
That's true, except a charity, you know, typically is a 501c3, and that has statutory parameters and people legally in charge of the money. And
so does a trust.
Yes, but not somebody who's walking down the street who's for Fred and is going to raise the money for Fred to be involved in litigation, and then over here it's going to be for Jane. So I'm just trying to cabin in where things can go, and you say, well, we've done certain things in the past. That's true. Whatever we do here, I think we ought to try and do it right.
I agree, but so, I think that there is a, you know, in the court context, obviously, it's the doctrine of stare decisis. I don't know that stare decisis applies to administrative agencies. It probably doesn't. Yeah. But I do think that there is it may be an APA requirement. But I don't know how the commission tells two congressmen that they can raise unlimited soft money for a ballot initiative 4 years ago and now tells us that raising for litigation, for voting rights litigation. I mean, I assume, by the way, that if you decide against draft A, someone ought to tell all the nonprofits that do civil rights litigation. I mean, I'm just sitting here listening to this. I suppose all of the, I mean, forget about the National Democratic Redistricting Trust, which is clearly involved in civil rights litigation with a partisan bent. But I suppose the same, if it's in connection with an election, it's in connection with an election, whether you're doing it for partisan reasons or nonpartisan reasons, I suppose. So it strikes me that if we're going down draft B, the commission ought to probably call through the civil rights community and tell them that we have now rolled back members' ability to raise for them too. I mean, it seems to me like this is a train that is really pretty far down. It's 40 years down the track or 30 years down the tracks, and has been reaffirmed several times since McCain-Feingold, and you know, here we are. So, yeah, I don't have a better answer for you, Commissioner, than that.
If I can just add one thing just about the advisory opinion process. I mean, the way it works, as I've always had it taught to me from the time I got out of law school, is that we assume the facts as presented by the requester is true. And if they don't, if the facts as presented by the requester are not true or do not turn out to be true, then the protection afforded by an advisory opinion would not extend to that requester. So I think in this situation, we have to assume that the facts as presented by the requester are true. And if they do not turn out to be true, then they will not be able to use that advisory opinion as a shield in the future. In terms of levels of verification before we can issue an advisory opinion, if we have to dig in too deep into the facts, then we really are going to make what's supposed to be a rather expeditious process under the statute, issuing an opinions within 60 days. That could become a very prolonged process, and I know that that's one thing that I think all of us share is a desire to get these opinions out as quickly as possible, especially in this being an election year. Even though this doesn't, this deals with redistricting, I think that's true regardless of the request. I'm wondering if at this point we ought to take a 5-minute recess to decide how to discuss how we want to move next. Is back in order. We've had a little discussion amongst ourselves about what to do next, and I guess since the request for more time has come from my friends to my right. I'm wondering if you would like to make a suggestion or state how you would wish to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it would. I don't think we need a lot more time. And I with apologies, Mr. Elias, that rulemaking thing that we did before might have looked easy, but it took a lot of time in the last week, and it took my attention in particular a lot in the last week. So I it's not that we forgot about you.
I understand.
There's only so many hours in a day, and I'm sorry to have to be the one to ask, but I think if we could have till next Friday, you know, we don't need to meet again. We can all do it on paper, and you know, we've heard at great length from you, and if you would give us that extra little bit more than a week, I think we might be able to get you an answer.
And that was one of the questions I asked of the general counsel is what, and this only betrays my own ignorance, nothing more, what is the, when you say we can do this on paper, what is the process? Again, I'm focused only on the issue of the chairs.
Well, let me tell you just some information about the way we work here. See,
you've this is been good. I'll write this. I'm going to write this.
You've been practicing before us all these years, and you never knew this. We don't have to do it at an open meeting. We send around these little pieces of paper. We have our own
could
little
ballots.
Could
have spared me all of this?
We could have. but you might not have gotten the same answer because it was so illuminating talking to you. We send around little pieces of paper. We vote on things all the time, okay, on talent. We call it voting on tally, and it can go around on a 3-day tally or a 2-week tally or a 1-hour tally. We've done 15-minute tallies. You know, as soon as everybody agrees, we sweep it around the office and everybody signs it, and we give it to the secretary, and it's a vote. And then we could tell you what the answer is as soon as we vote. And I'll tell you, I see no reason why we can't say this in open session, another dirty little secret. Some people have authority to sign for a commissioner who is unavoidably absent from the building, as long as it is authorized by that particular commissioner. You know, various members of our staffs can sign for us. So it does not actually require physical presence in the building, if that alleviates some of your concerns.
As long as it's not going to impede the ability of the chair to participate in the vote,
I think he can vote while he's changing diapers.
I just want to state my position clearly. As long as it's not going to impede his ability to participate in the vote, if the commission feels that the extra week will allow it to reach a 4-vote consensus, then I'm fine. Then I'm on board.
I think I saw. Commissioner Hunter, I think, then the Vice Chair, and then Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I've officially said in this public meeting, but I did write this in my summary of our ex parte communication yesterday, that I am in support of Draft A definitively and have been since the request came in. I would like to, and obviously I'd be willing to give more time, but there's no need to call for a vote on it if that's something that everybody's agreeable to do, but I'd just like to just say for the record that many people didn't think we'd be able to ever come up with a rule today on solicitation, and we did. So it's very possible that we come up with a draft A that has, you know, 5 or 6 votes or whatever. But I'm not sure, because draft A and draft B are so different, I just want to lay it out there that I'm not sure what language we would be able to come up with that would get the requisite 4 votes. I think just a yes answer would be easy, but I just want to make sure that's clear to the requestor and to my colleagues that, of course, I'm more than willing to look at anything that's presented to me, and I'm happy to negotiate anything, but I'm not terribly optimistic just based on comparing the 2 drafts and after hearing what's been said today in the public meeting that we're going to be able to come up with some language that is any different than yes. But
Vice
I could
Chair.
Be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the additional time is useful, and I think when we instituted this new policy of allowing requesters to come and discuss things with us and sometimes answer questions, I think that one of the aspects of the timing issue we didn't think about, and it is very difficult to predict because we don't know when requests actually, when the 60 days starts. We have meeting schedules set for some months in advance. This 60 days happens to expire the day after a meeting, so it doesn't really give us a lot of time to digest what I think has been a very helpful conversation, both with the requester and with our colleagues. So I think that is a consequence of adding this procedure, which I think is a good one, but it does have an impact on, in this instance, and I think in some others, on the 60-day issue. So I don't think we need additional time. I think, you know, getting us another 7 days or so to work through this, I think, and frankly, for those of us who were not in favor of Draft A, to work through some of the issues that we have discussed, I think would be productive.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Weintraub was explaining the processes. I thought, I'll probably have something to add. Actually, all that is in the commission directives, which is actually in the records room downstairs in a binder, but apparently still not on the website. So we have our procedures are actually public as long as you know where to find them.
Are they FOIAable?
Well, you don't have to FOIA them. You can go downstairs and look at them on the way out. I mean, there are. I guess they're FOIAable.
Will they give me a copy?
Well, you probably have to pay for your own copy.
That's okay.
But yeah, you can probably photocopy
I don't know
them.
Who I'm supposed to be looking at.
There's all kinds of information down there that, like you, I didn't realize was there. I had to come up in a case right before I got here, and then I thought, well, I can go see these secret directives, and then someone said, no, they're actually downstairs. You know, you just but they're just sitting there on the shelf, and it tells you all about tally votes and who votes and when we vote and how long we have to vote. All that is there. It's in the public. It just hasn't made it to the website because it's the sort of thing that between putting MERS and audits and things online, I guess it hasn't quite gotten there yet, but someday they'll be on the website. So you can get all kinds of hot tips on how the chairman will be able to vote regardless. So you can rest assured. My other point, going back to the substance, just a question, maybe assist people in thinking. Let's assume that the money is not for redistricting litigation per se, but it's more generalized voting rights. Say, for example, a municipality decides to move around the voting machines in a covered jurisdiction and they don't seek preclearance. And a member of Congress wants to raise money in that context. Is that in connection with an election? Is that the sort of thing Congress has decided that members ought not be able to lend their name to with respect to receiving, obtaining financial support for that sort of endeavor? Let's assume that municipalities in that member's congressional district, so I guess it would have some sort of impact potentially on his or her election, but it's not litigation in the Shaw v. Reno sense. Let's say it's a more mechanical Voting Rights Act litigation. Is there a distinction there, or is it just members raising money for this sort of thing in general is a problem? It's just something for thought to try to steer the discussion to more of a bigger picture as to what these sorts of groups are actually doing. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time to throw that out for thought.
Sure. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I promise you that if we come up with something that will get 4 votes and it requires the chairman's signature, and if for some reason there's no way to get it done in the building, I will personally drive the ballot to his house. Okay?
Good enough.
And I'll visit his baby at the same time.
I'll one-up you. I'll come here with my kid and a baby Bjorn to sign that if we can get that.
We would all love to see the baby.
So.
I remind my colleague how far apart we started on the solicitation rule, and yet we came up with something that I think everybody was pretty happy with at the end of the day. So, you know, we're not going to take that much time. We're just asking for a little bit over a week. Don't worry.
That's fine.
If I knew what the language was today that would get 4 votes, I'd give it to you today. I don't know what it is yet, but I remain optimistic that we can come up with something without making any commitments as to how I'm going to vote at the, you know, when it comes down to signing that piece of paper. You know, I remain optimistic that, you know, if you give us a few more days to mull over this stuff, that we might be able to come up with something.
Okay. Well, this matter will be held over until next Friday, and in the meantime, we will resume those discussions. It is 1:30. I originally was hoping that we might be able to get the full agenda in before lunch, but we're well into lunch hour. So maybe what we'll do is
break for lunch until, what do we say, can we make it a quick one, 2:30, so that we can get back? So we'll be in recess until 2:30. I think, Mr. Elias, we ought to talk more often. Or maybe we should just schedule, like, you know, the last Thursday each month is our mark.
Having a conference next week, you can come, ask questions, you know, participate. I mean, you can, you know, be part of the folks.
But thank you
for the commissioners for their time.
Thank you. We stand in recess.